Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. Do you remember the puzzle book for kids called Where's Waldo? My guest today could easily start his own guessing game, Where's Rolando? Rolando Beramendi is constantly in motion, popping up in places all over the world, well, at least between Italy and the United States. And everywhere he goes, he's constantly sharing his passion for food made with quality ingredients in the Italian way. And now he's written a book, Autentico, Cooking Italian the Authentic Way. Unlike many cookbooks, especially Italian cookbooks, Autentico goes far beyond just pasta. In a world where culinary shortcuts, adulteration, misleading labeling, and mass production, as the book's blurb says, where they seem to take over and they are labeled authentic food, they're not always authentic. And my guest, Rolando Beramendi, has written this book to kind of set the record straight there, but he is a culinary archaeologist, we're going to talk about that, culinary archaeologist, innovator, cooking teacher, bon vivant.
Big time.
Yeah. And he, with this book, and just with his passion, as I said, for good food, good Italian food, he has kept these centuries-old culinary traditions alive. Soon after graduating with a degree in economics from UC Davis, Rolando founded his company Manicaretti, the Italian fine food importer. He's a frequent winner of specialty food show awards and truly a chef's chef. His products and cooking classes and culinary expertise have been praised by so many of the well-known chefs around the country, on this side of the Atlantic and the other. With his importing company and his new cookbook, Rolando has crafted the perfect guide to authentic Italian food. I'm so pleased to have him here with me today. Welcome, Rolando.
Thank you, Linda, for having me.
We talked about so much before the show that I hope I don't forget to to bring it all back into play for the recording, because you are not only passionate about what you do, but you have so much energy. I mean, like the what is it called? The bunny rabbit,
the
energizer bunny.
Yeah. Little, yeah. Right? Like
you just that. Keep going. I mean, it's contagious. You talk about food and your love for food. But I do have some specific questions for you. First of all, the fact that you have culinary training. Did you go to culinary school?
No, not at all.
You've never been a chef in a restaurant?
I've been, cooking in different restaurants around the country and as well in Italy. And I had for a little while a little wine bar in the village, which was a wonderful place. And then, I just spent a lot of time in the kitchens and spending time learning, because I think that you can never stop learning. So I'm always trying to, you know, barge myself into people's kitchen and learn along with them.
Well, I mean, everyone just assumes that you are Italian, and we were talking beforehand that your pedigree is anything but purely Italian.
You got a little bit
of everything in there.
I'm a big mutt. I was born in the Patagonia in the south of Argentina, and my family is, I'm a quarter Latvian and a quarter Swedish from my mother's side, and then I'm a quarter Italian and Tuscan and Basque on my father's side.
Well, so, obviously it's a good mix for food.
I don't know. I think, you know, look what happened. I'm 2 meters tall, right? 6'7". I think the genetic pool went berserk with me. So.
Well, and not unlike Where's Waldo. I mean, you know, a picture of finding you, you're easy to pick out because you stand, you know, heads and you know, heads above everyone else. But going to school in California in economics, I mean, how did you take that dive into the food world?
It just happened. I don't think that there was, you know, I had a plan or I went to college with an idea of this is what I'm going to do. I just happened to be in a period at UC Davis where it was still very small. We were entering class of 300 students, so it was very small. Now it looks like a shopping center. It's so big. But then I was also in charge of the International Student Association, and I started to do all these evenings that we would call them cultural nights. So all the students from different countries, they had to organize a dinner party for all the other students, and we would all eat their food and share.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And so I got to meet a lot of, you know, the people from different parts of the world. But there was a particular friend of mine, his name is Alessandro Valecchi, and he was very key in bringing me to Florence. In fact, he's part of my dedication to the book is to him, because he was involved with a very famous family in Italy called the Frescobaldi family, which you may have heard, or wine and olive oil producers. And he was in charge of developing this new consortium of olive oil that set the new standards about olive oil quality. And when I, all of a sudden, you know, I got married, I went to cook a dinner in the Alps at my former wife's uncle. And I was always the one cooking because I love to cook. And all of a sudden, these people showed up with a basket full of goodies, of wonderful artisan food. And they said, would you help us find, you know, someone in the United States to import these products? Mind you, I was 22 years old. So you're fearless at that age.
Yeah, yeah.
And the world was very different then, you know. There were not all the worries of, you know, today. And so I made a lot of appointments with different importers and retailers around the Bay Area where I was living. And they all threw me out. They all said, are you crazy? Who's going to buy these products? And so I started to bring them into my garage, and now Manicaretti is almost 30 years old.
Hmm. I mean, yet I think that San Francisco Bay Area, there was such a large Italian population, and, you know, the North Beach area.
Yeah, but do you remember the olive oils and the goodies that we could find Italian food 30 years ago? They were very different than the ones that you can find today.
Absolutely. And even still, in some parts of cities all around, you know, not large cities, around America, you still can't find, you know, the really good products.
I think it's all a matter. I think that I was at the right time at the right place, because the food revolution was just starting in California. And had it not been for the whole Californian cuisine sort of developing at that time, they were so hungry for products from all over the world.
Yeah.
And the Italian ingredients were key to developing.
Yeah,
that,
they fit right in. Yeah, right. That was right in there.
Now they make their own, but, you know, at that time they didn't. And so now, you know, at that time.
That begs another question for later on. So you founded your company.
Yeah, and, you know.
Called Manicaretti,
which means little treats or little delicacies or, you know, sort of beautiful morsels that you eat. And I went around the country, you know, with my car full of samples and met all the wonderful chefs and the incredible people, retailers who have made them all happen. And I'm, as I told you, I think once before, I do believe that all these products are alive and kicking thanks to the American chefs and the American shopkeepers, the specialty food trade, because without them, you know, we don't know what would have happened to many of these products, you know?
That's right. Well, you know, it's not unlike the founder of Heritage Foods. He kept alive small producers of meats by, you know, taking them, you know, as you did. And
giving them a market, yes.
Yeah, giving them a market, selling them to different restaurants and chefs.
And it was very important for me, this whole back and forth and this whole thing of where's Rolando? Like you said, the Waldo, my back and forth is... It was very important for me to bring them to Italy to see how these products were made and spend a lot of time in Italy so that you can share with them the same experience, you know, of going into people's homes or going into people's restaurant and opening the doors. And the most wonderful thing about Italians is that they're going to throw open their doors, cook for you, they share their recipe, they tell you every secret, you know, it's... They're the most wonderful people in the world that way.
Yeah. Well, Ina Garten, the Barefoot Contessa, wrote a beautiful foreword for you to the book.
Yeah, and she's so dear.
And she talks about going to Italy with you and going to, actually, to Sicily.
Sicily,
right?
Yes, we were.
And exactly as you described it, going into people's homes, having people cook for them, discovering all the products. Fun. Someone's got to do it.
I think it's, you know, you can walk around any place in Italy nowadays, still today, and just ask for a recipe, and they will give it to you. So that's the beauty of Italy, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, in this book, Autentico, meaning authentic, you say that the secrets, you sort of are spreading the secrets to good quality cooking, traditional Italian cooking, and that's to have a well-stocked pantry.
Yes.
And you kind of flipped you just told me right before we sat down, you flipped the book upside down. Yeah, right. Tell us about that. You decided to put it first?
Most of it, you know, the cookbooks that I have seen, you know, on Italian food or any food whatsoever, sometimes I feel that the best recipes are the ones that are almost in the last chapter, the last things, the sauces, the reductions, or things that you should have, your resources, right?
Yeah.
And so I consider myself to be a supply-side cook, not a demand-side cook. I cook with what I have. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important that you have a well-stocked pantry with lots of beautiful things from all over the world, not just Italy. And then I also consider my fridge to be part of my pantry because, we're all very busy during the week working. And so what I do on Sundays is I make my chicken stocks or my paste and my beans. I also make mashed potatoes and have them there, you know. And so you can then come home from your busy day and in some of the recipes in the book, in 30 minutes, if you have those things, it looked like you cooked all day.
Yeah, so it's that's the great thing about it.
Yeah.
But the important thing, of course, is the taste. And I can tell by looking at the pictures that they just taste wonderful. I mean, you don't see a lot of extraneous ingredients hanging around on the plate.
Well, I just wanted to write a book that it sort of embodies the beautiful philosophy of the simple and authentic Italian cooking that I know. That is a very simple philosophy of it is what it is and that's how it will be. And so I wanted to write the recipe exactly like I learned from that particular person who is in the book, you know, and taught me how to do that. And most likely, maybe, you know, the people across the street or the next door neighbors, the grandmother, you know, cooks it in a different way. But the recipes that I learned, they each have the name of the person who basically taught me that, and I just wanted to do it the way that it is.
Yeah, and that's what I really did want to enter into a discussion about, that word authentic. And you say, well, the grandmother who lives next door may cook it a little different way.
Yeah.
And yet it's still the basic dish, the basic recipe. She may, you know, change things a little bit. Because there is a lot of controversy over authenticity and who owns the dish and who, you know, who cooks it the absolute authentic way.
Yes.
And that's like finding a needle in a haystack because, as you say, you know, you go door to door to door in the same block and everyone cooks it just a little bit differently.
Yeah, and of course everybody's going to say, you know, you need to add a cup of cream or, you know, you have to put, you know, some butter in it. You know, take, for example, ragu, right? Meat ragu. The Accademia Italiana della Cucina has registered, recognizes
right.
14 types of ragu.
And it's and one of the original ones, it is a registered recipe. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah. So, you know, of course there's going to be disagreements, but that's the beauty of Italy. You know, that's one of the most wonderful things. I mean, I even wrote it in the book about, you know, simple d'Arosticiana, even how do you pronounce it, let alone what's in the dish. I mean, there's going to be like discussions like crazy over about how do you write it, how you spell it, how you pronounce it. But that's authentic. You know, that's what I wanted to capture with the book, is to show that there is no right or wrong, that this is the way that I know it, and this is the way that I have learned over 30 years of going back and forth and living in Italy. And I just wanted to share with everybody what I know. And this is the way that I know it. This is what it is.
Yeah. Well, certainly you have learned a lot and even more about food over that 30 years. You split your time pretty equally between Florence and San Francisco.
And New York, yeah.
And New York, and like New York. Okay.
The corridor, yeah. The corridor.
Yeah. I just, you know, I still sort of, you know, questioned, you know, why so many cookbooks on the shelves. Well, you just answered that basically, I guess. You know, why another cookbook?
Yeah, that's exactly what I asked, you know, when I was first approached to put together a proposal for writing a cookbook. I said, who needs another Italian cookbook? There's hundreds of them. I mean, if you look into any cookbook store or bookshops, that's the largest section, the Italian.
Right.
But they're mostly pasta and pizza-centric. Everything seems to be very carb-centric.
Yeah. And yet, even with, you know, the simpler meat-vegetable dishes, mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times, and I'm sure it happens to you, that I'm approached by people, because they know that I do a lot of Italian mm-hmm. cooking, and they'll say, oh, gee, how can you tell me how you make? And it'll be like the simplest dish. And you realize people are really hungry for the simple instructions, the simple recipes. And one, you asked me before the show began what I thought of the book and, you know, did I like it? No, I don't like it. Of course I like it. How could I not like it? And one of the things that I, my comments to you was, and I will repeat it, is that it's a very approachable book on all, for anyone of any cooking level. You explain things so thoroughly, and the ingredient list is never more than, six ingredients, and that's probably a lot for most of them.
Yes.
And the instructions are simple. I mean, I'm looking at recipes. I think, oh, well, it's a couple pages long. It's like, you know, three quarters of a page. Or a
I
page
just
long.
Wanted to write a book that is about the do's, not the don'ts.
The don'ts,
you know,
right?
how many cookbooks you see, you say, oh, don't do this and don't do that. If you do this, you're going to burn it. I just, you know, I wanted to write a cookbook that it just makes you want to do it, that it should make you want to, like, eat it, right?
Yeah, definitely. And though that's just you say there's so many cookbooks on the shelves and mostly Italian, because everybody loves Italian food, and you don't really get tired of it. You know, I love Malaysian food. I love Thai food. I love French food. There's a food I don't love. But you can't eat it every single night. Sometimes. I mean, some people. Mm. You know, I can't eat it every single night. But I don't think that a lot of people ever really get tired of eating Italian food, because you eat a dish, and I could leaf to something in your book. Maybe you could come up with it for me. But a simple dish, and it's maybe a meat dish or a vegetable dish, and you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, that's Italian.
Mm-hmm.
But it is. And it's just simple and, you know, and tastes good, tastes of the ingredients, tastes fresh.
I mean, it was very difficult for me to, you know, choose 125 recipes in which, you know, I mean, you know, I could write maybe five more volumes of things that I know. But I wanted to choose the recipes that they would actually be about a certain technique, a way that you approach the food. And then once you master that little technique, then you can add things or take things out or do whatever. But, you know, it's just, it's very important. I think that if you cook all those recipes from the first one to the last one, you have basically mastered the way of a simple house, you know, household in Italy.
And then nowadays, you can apply it to,
then you apply it to whatever ingredients you want.
Is this what you refer to when you, or it's been said about you, keeping traditions alive?
Yes. And that's what I was telling you before. I mean, this to me, I feel that Italian food has gone astray. It's just, you know, we've complicated so much. Look what has happened to poor burrata. I mean, burrata and puglia, they just serve it to you simply on a plate with, you know, cut in quarters, and maybe they'll drizzle some olive oil. Now you go to any restaurant around the country here in the U.S., and the burrata has become the new caviar almost, and they put everything you can imagine on it. And I say, well, what's wrong with just burrata, right? It's simple.
Just simple cheese with creamy center. Yeah, well, I mean, what could be better?
And some good olive oil, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about good olive oil. We're going to talk about olive oil and so much more when we come back after a short break.
I'm Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene and Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Bob's Red Mill to find out from Bob himself why his products taste so good. So what's the secret, Bob?
To make the best whole grain flour, we look back in time. No modern technology can match the old world engineering of a stone mill.
Wow. Bob's Red Mill is using stone mills? How old are we talking here?
Well, the stone mills are practically as old as mankind, and no matter what civilization they uncover, they find two stones that people were rubbing together to make something they could eat, whole wheat flour. But the stones that we use are quarried near Paris, France, in La Ferté, and it's the same stone material from the same quarry that the Romans used to make stone mills all over the Roman Empire, of which you can testify by looking at Pompeii. It's a quartz material. It has a uniqueness about it. It's very hard. It has a certain porosity, and they put the stones together in a unit of 20 pieces and band it so that they use only the best and sharpest parts. It's an ingenious thing, but very old. I mean, thousands of years old. So it's pretty cool.
Those sound like some really special stones. How do they work?
Stones turn either the top or the bottom stone, turning at 100 to 125 revolutions per minute, produce a lovely 3-4 up to 500 pounds, depends on how soft the grain is. The bottom stone is the bedstone, and it's also called the nether stone in the Bible. But it also now turns for some configurations.
Would you say that using stone mills lead to healthier grains?
I know they do. I can watch it. I showed you. You know it as well as I do. The grain goes in the top, goes through the stones, and it comes out. We don't lose anything, and we don't add anything.
Thanks for sharing the story of how Bob's Red Mill is using ancient technology to keep their products on the cutting edge.
Michael, we think that we can make a difference by sticking by the traditional way of stone milling whole grain, and that's what we're doing.
You can learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hi, welcome back. I'm talking with Rolando Beramendi, and he's the food guru is what he is.
Oh, my man.
Yeah. He's written a book called Autentico, Cooking Italian the Authentic Way. And it really is as has been written about it, an introduction to the true flavors of Italy. What you do with them is up to you, but you know, you really do give a good explanation of the flavors, as you said, sort of, it's like a suggest, and then the recipes that follow are a suggestion of what to do with those ingredients, right?
Yeah, and also I think, you know, one of the things that I wanted to let people know as well, I mean, the first ingredient that I think is the pillar and the base of everything that you're going to cook, the most important ingredient in my kitchen is extra virgin olive oil.
Mm-hmm. And now we are here, as we're recording this, it's November, so we are celebrating the season of the new oil this year.
Yes, it was quite exciting to see it. That actually, on Sunday, you'll be tasting some. So
it's a celebration of the book on Sunday. Right?
Yeah, so I don't think there's an ingredient that really can change the way that your food tastes more so than using a good extra virgin olive oil. Mm. And in the book, I went even further out, specifying whether you should use a cooking olive oil, whether you have a mild olive oil, a medium olive oil, or a robust olive oil. And also make room for the freshly pressed olive oil, which is about
it, right,
to come.
Right.
Because I think that depending on what role does the olive oil play in the recipe, the simpler the list of ingredients, it becomes the most important ingredient. It's your emulsifier, it's your sauce. So the simpler the recipe, the higher the quality your olive oil should be.
Interesting.
So I tried, you know, that was a really fun way to try to, you know, so you should have, I have sometimes 7, sometimes 10 types of olive oil in my kitchen because that's what I do and that's what I love. But I always say to my friends, imagine having one type of olive oil in your kitchen. It'll be like drinking the same wine every day. You'll be bored out of your mind after a while, right?
Yeah. And learning to taste the olive oil will give people an idea of what you're talking about when you say, you know, the more robust and the less. And I think Americans in particular are becoming more educated.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Look at what has happened in the last 30 years. I mean, before, there used to be oil in a can and in the bottom shelf.
That was it.
Now there's quite a bit of assortment. Sometimes these specialty food shops, they have an olive oil section that it looks almost like a wine shop.
That's right. And they offer actually offer tastings.
Yeah,
if you're not sure
so
about
great.
The oil.
That's the beauty of this country.
Great olive oil, but let's talk a little bit about some of the unfortunate things that have happened. You talk about that you wanted to present authentic ingredients, and so often things are mislabeled, and people are saying, oh, it's Italian, real Italian. You got to look at where it comes from. But then the olive oil, there have been problems with that.
Yeah,
can you give a brief explanation on that?
But there's also happens to, you know, designer bags and fancy cars.
Yeah, yes,
and,
you know. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
I mean, Made in Italy is one of the greatest, is the greatest brand in the world, you know. So if you say it's Made in Italy, it sells. It's just that immediately your product goes up, you know, 50%. So many products do get processed in Italy or packaged in Italy, and then therefore they're allowed to be exported that way. And so Italy is it's sort of like the refinery of all good, of beautiful things, right? And so many of the products from around the Mediterranean or from other parts of the world, they come to Italy, they get assembled in Italy, and they have that possibility to put that Made in Italy and take, you know, advantage of that brand. And unfortunately, then that gets too complicated with politics and, you know, multinational corporations and publicly traded corporations. And I want to continue to promote the authentic products. And I think that's the best thing that we can do, because if we really use the authentic products, then those other products would cease to exist. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for a chain of Italian restaurants across the country with more than 100 restaurants to switch to an oil that is made in the authentic way or with lots of integrity, because then food costs will go up to the wazoo.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that it's always, isn't that what it gets down to? I mean, you know, like they can, we can get that to you for half the price.
So,
well,
Yeah, but the thing is, that who's to blame? The producer selling the bottle of olive oil, you know, for half the price, or the chef who's buying it and using it? Yeah. We need to make people stop buying them. My last page in Autentico is a call to action of that, of just saying, don't buy them anymore, you know? I mean, don't use those things that are not authentic, and then they'll just go away.
It'll disappear eventually. Yeah. And what about shortcuts in... You say shortcuts are something that sort of eroded traditional recipes. Explain what you mean by what shortcuts.
Well, I think shortcuts are for lack of a better word, it would be things that are already frozen or prepackaged and made, you know, in order that they make it to the restaurants. Or I would call one of the greatest shortcuts is a bouillon cube, you know. there's a recipe in the book for aquacotta that it's one of the most beautiful soups, the simplest soups that you can imagine, from Tenuta di Capezzana and right outside of Florence. And Marcella Hasan in The Essentials of Italian Cooking, she calls the Contessa Lisa Contini Bonacosi the greatest home cook in Italy. Well, and one of the ingredients is actually bouillon cube, you know. But we, nowadays, if you go to Capezzana, bouillon cube doesn't exist in the kitchen. No, we've graduated from that. Now we make, you know, everybody makes a wonderful broth. And so I think that if we stop using bouillon cube, for example, as a shortcut, then they wouldn't be at the shelves anymore.
Yeah. And you do, as you gave your own shortcuts, I mean, if you will,
these are
authentic food shortcuts for making these things, like you say. You
turn beans
Sunday into a preparation day. Right.
Yeah.
And some stocks and freeze and sofrito, the stocks. Yeah.
Yes, all those things. I think that you can, those shortcuts, as long as you're making them yourself and you're buying them with, and making them with good ingredients, you make them and have them at home ready to go. Those are great to have. But there's a lot of products out there that shouldn't exist anymore.
you travel in throughout. I mean, I know you travel throughout the Italy, searching for products for your business. But you also just have this way of kind of getting into people's lives and meeting people and finding out so much about them. As far as the cooking and the food, is there? You don't want people to not like you, but one particular region that is your favorite?
No, because I think that, you know, even though I've been living in Florence, and Florence is my home, and Florence has the most carnivore diet of all of Italy. I mean, they eat steak and game, and, you know, everything is with ragu, and it's just so carnivorous, you know, as a diet. Every now and then I just take the train, which is so you know, fantastic in Italy, and I can go to Venice or go to Bologna or go to Rome for the day and just go detox from, you know, go eat vegetables, you know, and change my diet, you know, because I think that the most wonderful thing about Italy is that aspect of it, that there is no homogeneous cuisine, that you can travel from the other side of the hill and you'll have a completely different menu. And that's the beauty of Italy for me. I love the variety. Even, you know, if you think about it, the wine also. I mean, there's like 1,300 varieties of grapes, you know, grown in Italy. It's just so beautiful.
Well, I realize that you did have a lot of, I'm going to say, not favorites, but that you embraced the specialties of so many different regions. And I was so surprised when I turned one page and saw the stuffed rice
crown,
the stuffed rice crown
from Napoli.
And I thought, well, now see, that's something that a lot of people would not expect would be, you know, a rice dish as the centerpiece of, you know, of a meal Italy.
It's such a wonderful celebratory dish. I mean, it's actually the most complicated recipe in the book.
It was,
as you noticed.
Yes, it was.
It's 2 pages long and 2 pages long of ingredients. But it's every now and then it's so wonderful to be able to make a dish like that. You know, it's like when I make also the bolito misto once a year. You know, there's something really great about cooking a dish like that and pouring your heart into making it and then sharing it with your friend and with your friends and family. And that's what I call, you know, part of my being authentic. It's mm-hmm. just acknowledging the people who make the food, sharing the food, and then, you know, make people enjoy it.
And rice. I mean, I think that Americans think, oh, everything's pasta. And then they go, mm-hmm. if they travel in Italy, they realize, you know, go too far north and you're mm-hmm. not going to get a lot of that pasta. You go too mm-hmm. far south, you're not going to get a lot of that. But, you know, it's interesting how things do change. And, yeah. You know, the variety of foods are very regional.
And yeah. And that's what
we celebrate
so
that. Yeah. I talked to you about this. Things I love finding things that surprise me in books, you know, something different, something new that I maybe had not thought of or noticed or knew about before. And your one section on dishes, rather than calling them appetizers or first courses or vegetable dishes, you have a section called segare.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what segare are.
It's slicing. It's cutting things, you know, roughly and putting them according to the season or whatever you find in the market, or you may have leftovers in your fridge.
Because segare means
to saw right? And to, you know, to use, you know, and cut them and so, you know, put porcini mushrooms with pecorino and fennel, or you can do beets and gorgonzola and walnuts, or you can do blood oranges and lemon and red onions, and depending on the season, you just. I did also. There's one that I slice zucchini, and then they're poached basically very lightly in acidulated water, so water with vinegar and a little bit of salt and sugar, and then I lay it as a lattice, like you do a crostata.
Yeah. You know? The picture of that is gorgeous, by the way.
Yeah, I had the fortune of, you know, working with one of the most beautiful and most incredible photographers, Laurie Frankel. I mean, the book is a work of art more than anything, yeah, thanks to her photography.
And that it was, it's something so simple, and yet it looks so wonderful. So all these dishes, and I think we're seeing a lot more of that in this country, are these composed salads, if you will, but I mean, they're, you know, slices of yes. unexpected ingredients together, sort mm-hmm. of, and there you go. That's yeah. your dish. A little dousing of some wonderful oil,
yes.
And there you have it.
It's a beautiful appetizer. I think yeah. it's just one of the greatest ways to start a meal.
Okay, so as we finish up here, I have to ask you the tough questions.
Oh la la.
A favorite dish all time? Anything?
Yes, I've thought about it for a long time, and I've been asked that question before, and thank God that I can say it with very happily. It would be spaghetti alla carbonara.
That's an easy one for me, too.
I eat spaghetti alla carbonara literally every Saturday for lunch. I mean, that's my... It's part of my routine, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just... I find it so... satisfying, and I can't think of my life without spaghetti.
And the tradition and background of that, of course, it's still kind of hazy. There are all yeah, kinds of folklore, course. You know, yeah. surrounding the, you yeah. know, the history of that dish. Just like puttanesca. I mean, those are two very storied recipes. You know,
but there are plenty of books and plenty of authorities who have already set that record straight. I didn't think that I needed to.
No, you didn't.
Without ending, yeah. I basically what I did is I wrote the way that I cook it, and which I basically do it with a raw egg, and mixed it with a lot of pecorino romano. That has to be the real stinky one, mm-hmm. not the one out of a jar.
right.
And lots of it. And I think it's
and
just...
And do you use guanciale?
And I use guanciale, of yeah. course. Mm-hmm. And that was quite an achievement for me to be able to print guanciale on the book
yeah.
instead of pancetta.
That's See? Right.
So it's guanciale, not or pancetta. So that's why I call it its authentic way.
yeah, and it's interesting because... You know, then we have to run around here in this country and try to find some good pecorino romano. You have to go out and find some guanciale. But in an Italian household, in particular areas, they would be more or less staples in the household. So you always had an egg, you always had some pecorino, you had some guanciale.
Yes.
Boom, you throw together the you know, the pasta, and there you have it. Ah, it's you can eat it for breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
Exactly, and I love to make always more, because then I like to have leftover, because then what you do is you take a nonstick pan, put a little bit of butter the next day or in the evening or whenever you're hungry, and I make it like a frittata.
A little frittata, oh, yes.
And so then it's delicious, and you serve it like little wedges as a contorno. It's quite pleasant.
Or as my kids say, spaghetti pie, right? Yeah, that's great. Okay, the next question is, do you have a particular pet peeve about ingredients? And we may have covered it already about people thinking they're cooking Italian with Italian ingredients. What would be your pet peeve?
I would say, if I understand what pet peeve is, is
something that ruffles your feathers and bothers
that
you.
Ruffers,
yes, yeah.
There's just this addiction of everything sweet in this country. The idea that you need to, you know, that it has to be on a, the tendency for everything for me is that it goes on a sweeter side, and this mania of putting balsamic vinegar on everything. And, you know, it's just, I think the worst thing that happened to balsamic vinegar, it's like what Marcella Hassan said once a long time ago, is the worst thing that happened to balsamic vinegar is that they put it in a salad. You know, I think that, you know, the beautiful flavors of eating Italian food is that roller coaster of flavors that you get, that you go from. And in Italy, you eat a lot more bitter flavors. And bitter is a wonderful flavor. I keep on talking always about, you know, bitter. There's lots of recipes that many people will first, you know, their first reaction when they eat it, it's kind of, this is so bitter. And I go, but that's beautiful. That's what it should be. Amaro is a beautiful flavor.
That's right.
And I think that, you know, just not everything has to be sweet. You know, acidity and bitterness are a wonderful repertoire of the wonderful roller coaster of flavors that you get when you're in Italy eating with the Italians.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, la carugula should be bitter and spicy. It shouldn't be sweet. Broccoli should be bitter and angry. It shouldn't be sweet.
Anyone that you would thank or attribute to your either greatest learning of cooking or your introduction to learning to cook and learning the traditions, the old traditions of Italy?
There's only one person that I can think of, and he's actually on the plane right now with his wife, coming over, the landing at 5:45 today at JFK. And I'm just so honored. He's 83 years old. He's the man who basically taught me what authenticity means. And there's a beautiful essay that I dedicated to him in the book. His name is Carlo Cioni, and he owns a restaurant on top of the hills outside of Florence called Da Delfina, which to me is what I like I said in the book, I call him he's been like a father figure, like my guru and my pope, and I consider Da Delfina my Vatican, you know, because it's them. I think that's what, you know, being authentic is all about, is just being somebody like him, you know, who is so, somebody with so, you know, for somebody who's a nomad and a mutt like me to see somebody who has such deep roots.
He's been there forever, right?
He's been there forever. He's so kind and so gentle and so generous about sharing everything that he knows. And, you know, he's just been sort of like the father I never had. So, and he's coming just to, you know, celebrate the launch of Autentico. So I'm pretty, you know, it's a big day for me today, Linda.
So I will have a chance to meet him?
Yes, you will on Sunday.
Oh, I look forward to coming, that. Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, Rolando, I can't tell you how pleased I am that you took the time on your brief trip here this time around to share with us your takes on on Italian traditions and authentic ingredients. Mm,
thank you for having me, and thank you for being the first interview of Authentico.
Well, it's my honor too, right? It's great. And again, the book is Authentico, Cooking Italian the Authentic Way by Rolando Beramendi. And thanks for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past with your host, me, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.